called to order and present for the record. We do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senators Huggins, Stedman, French, Wilikowski, and myself, McGuire. It's February the 11th, and it's 3:35, and we have one item on the agenda today, the little small issue of in-state use of cook inlet gas. And before we started, Senator French said that if we had just taken all the time that we'd had in hearings talking about this issue and that of building a bullet line, and instead of having hearings, we took a shovel and put our minds to it, we might have actually built a pipeline by now and solved the problem. So yet again, we will have another hearing, and I appreciate all of you coming down today. I know that it's a big deal to fly in and come away from the important jobs that you're doing. So we're going to start with Chugach Electric and their perspective. We have Phil Steyer here and Bradley Evans, and without further ado, we'll let you tell us your story.
All right, through the chair, appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all about a very important matter, and with that, we're just going to dive right into it. We've got a PowerPoint here to frame our presentation to you. Just a quick overview. We're Alaska's largest electric utility. We generate about half the state's electric energy. We're vertically integrated. We have generation, transmission, distribution. Gas has a lot to do on the generation end. Retail, wholesale, and economy energy sales. Chugach has a little over 80,000 metered retail locations, and we serve about 200 plus thousand metered retail or locations through our wholesale contracts and economy energy sales to Golden Valley. Just a review on production here, 2,700 gigawatt hours, or the number there for energy, and wholesale is 48%, retail 43%, economy energy 9%. Our operating revenues of $288 million, and by broken down again by the members who pay that. The Rail Belt grid, we serve power up and down. Do I have to push that on? I'm doing fine. We serve power up and down the Rail Belt grid through various wholesale contracts and through our own retail membership. The Rail Belt grid broken down into load center areas, the interior, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Mat-Su, and Kenai are interconnected by very weak links. They have about 75 megawatts of capacity with each one of those links, so we don't have the ability to necessarily transfer generation from one end all the way to the other without some restriction. Rail Belt generation is about a little north of 1,500 megawatts of installed capacity.
Madam Chair?
We have an annual peak
Senator
load of
French.
About...
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Evans, could you just go back to that last point about the difficulty of moving power up and down the grid? What's the physical restriction, you know, and just maybe to put it in terms that those of us that are laymen can understand, if Fairbanks lost its electrical, its ability to generate electricity, could we move enough power from the Anchorage generating stations to keep their lights on? That's just sort of the way I think of it.
The short answer is no, but the way the system grew up is there... All of the utilities at one time were isolated, and they sort of grew up over the years and then interconnected. And right now, in each one of those load center areas, you have enough generation to serve the load there. So if you lost the interconnection, you could use the local area generation to serve that load. But we don't have the ability, to move enough power to power Fairbanks over that tie there. Their demand is probably around 200 megawatts on peak, and you've got a 70-megawatt tie. The Kenai is around an 80 to 90 megawatt load, and you've got a 70 megawatt tie. We're usually moving power south off the Kenai up into the Anchorage Mat-Su area.
Thank you.
So we are constrained by those transmission lines. Rail Belt has a little north of 1,500 megawatts of installed electric capacity. Our peak load is between 850 and 900 megawatts. Mm-hmm. Of that, Chugach has 530 installed, and through lease agreements for a unit down on Kenai and Bradley, our share of Bradley Lake, it totals 629 megawatts. Today, our fuel mix.
Yes, Senator French.
Yes. I'm sorry to jump in so much, but why on the Rail Belt capacity versus load? Why? How do you explain that huge difference? Why is there so much overcapacity there than what we're actually using on an annual basis?
And my apologies through the chair.
Oh, that's fine.
You're talking about the 1,500 megawatts of installed capacity.
Yes.
In the annual.
Yes.
Well, we're required to have a certain amount of reserves. We usually shoot for about 30% planning reserves. And part of the original thing was each area, before it was interconnected, had its own generation. And then you interconnected it, and then you had a surplus. Out of that, it's not all efficient, though. And there's various age problems with that. So out of all that installed capacity, some of that you'd like not to run because it's very old generation, 40-plus years old. We have some stuff that's approaching 50 years old. So it's sitting down in the reserves, kind of the Alaska thing. We never throw anything away. As long as we can keep it running, we will. It's not our first unit of choice. So out of that, you know, our base load is a little bit south of that peak load. So as far as the efficient generation, we're less than peak load, and then we have peaking and that above that. And then if you look at, for example, hydro, you don't have 100% load factor there. You can't run it all the time. So if you have a couple hundred megawatts of hydro, out of that we can only run that about 30 or 40% of the time. So you don't have sometimes all of that there all of the time. And then, like I said before, it's geographically distributed across that region, so you're going to end up with that. But that's the long answer to it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Today, in the Chugach system, our generation is fired 90% with natural gas, and the balance of that 10% is from hydro. Mm-hmm. Our long-term vision is to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels for various reasons, supply, security, environmental reasons. There's new liabilities associated with fossil fuel generation, and we think renewables is the way to go, and we've got a hook on that, 90-10 to 10-90. Today we're 90% fossil fuel and 10% hydro, and we'd like to have that vision out there of 10% fossil fuel and 90% renewable. What that portfolio mix is yet to be determined, and we're working on that, and we'll get to that later.
We'd love to have an update on that as you continue to look at what that portfolio mix might be as we look forward to an energy policy for the state. Be interesting to see how individual utilities are setting goals and going about meeting them for their renewable energy portfolio.
Later on, we'll get into that a bit, and hopefully that'll satisfy that update. Right now, we have four natural gas suppliers: Marathon, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, and MLMP. We have four contracts. The contracts are indexed to three commodities: WTI, heating oil, and natural gas. And the prices change quarterly based on how those commodities react in the open market. They're volumetric contracts, and they'll be consumed in 2010 and 2011, and we're currently negotiating. I think that's on the next slide.
Senator Wilikowski.
Can you talk a little bit about the status of your negotiations to get gas supply into the future?
Through the chair, that's really difficult for me to give you the ends. We have confidentiality agreements. We are negotiating right now today. It's not been the easiest negotiations. I've been involved in negotiations for other types of fuel, coal, and HAYGO and natural gas before, and they've not been easy, but I think we're going to get to that later about the divergent interest of all the parties that are involved in the natural gas mix, but they're ongoing.
Senator Wilikowski.
You filed something with the Ninth Circuit Federal District Court, or Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, I should say.
Not as part of our gas negotiations.
Okay. What was the rationale for filing to block the DOE extension of the LNG?
We didn't necessarily agree with LNG exports.
Do you think shipping LNG outside has an impact on Chugach's ability to negotiate a reasonable price for Cook Inlet consumers, Rail Belt consumers?
I think you have to reach a balance between those economic interests, and we understand that LNG exports are important for production out in the Cook Inlet, and what we understand is that there might be a loss of reserves out there if they don't produce at a certain rate. So we understand that those are important, and we understand that those are different economic interests, and they're not perfectly aligned.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned your objective mix of 10 and 90% with fossil and renewables. In the near term, if we had a increased supply of natural gas, would that help you and make you more optimistic?
Through the chair, could you say that one more time? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Yeah, my second question will be to you, when do you think you're going to have your 10 and 90% mix, and how long you need an increased supply availability for natural gas?
Through the chair, that is probably why we're here today. I mean, that is the question. We're very concerned that through the policies that we have out there now and the mix of players that we have in this and what's available on our plate, that there is a security issue out there about supply and making that switch. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody else out there that can do that. I mean, I heat my home with Instar gas, so I have the same concern, and they don't have a substitute. We might be able to get to a substitute. We think that a reasonable transition period to at least make a substantial headway into that would be at least 10 years. So is there an issue between now and 10 years? Yes, there's an issue. And is there a tail on that? Yes, there's a tail on that. There's an issue with supply there. We'll get to some of that later. That might give you more specifics on what we think should be done and could be done.
Thank you.
Excellent. Senator Wilikowski.
How much does Chugach pay right now on average for the natural gas that they buy?
Just go ahead and pop it then. We've got that right there. Our current average price is $6.67 per MCF in the first quarter of 2009. We consume about 30 BCF a year, and there's the breakdown in the allocation of costs between our turbines and a lease turbine.
And if I could follow up, then,
Senator Murkowski?
And if you had a deal similar to the deal that NSTAR struck with their recent 22% increase, what would that do to the consumers in South Central's electricity bills?
Well, I might need some help on that. I think that that weighted WACOG cost was around $8. If you just ratchet it up $6.67 to that, you're looking at another 20%+ increase. So in our bill that. You know, our bill is about a little over half of our bill is gas, so you have to ratchet that with. So if I got my percentages right, I hate to do math on the fly here, but I'm naked without my calculator, so that percentage increase was 30, then roughly be about a 15% increase. Here's a component of a typical monthly residential bill based on about 700 kilowatt hours. You can see the impact of fuel on our bill. And on the base rate component, we're a little bit different than NSTAR. NSTAR, they deliver the commodity. They deliver the molecules. We take the molecules and convert them to a different energy form. And there's a tremendous cost associated with that energy conversion. So the base rate part of our bill is built upon that, the energy conversion and the delivery of electricity. So it's a little bit different breakdown than NSTAR, where the majority of their bill is gas. We're a little north of 50%. And you can see from 93 to 09, we've done a pretty fair job of keeping that base rate conversion cost relatively flat. Current activities, we mentioned this before, the contracts are underway. We're doing some things on the... There's demand side and supply side, and on the supply side, we're engaged in building more efficient combined cycle generation so we can lower our consumption of fuel. That's anywhere from 25 to 40% efficient, depending on which unit it shuts down. We're working, we have a conservation program that we've implemented, and it's underway, and we're seeing the effects of that. We've got some, not here today, but we have had good results of that already. And we're also working on renewables. To date, most of the renewables that we're working on are small. There's the wind project. There's some small Runner River Hydro and some other projects like that. We don't have good news on wind today, but we do have news on some other small renewable projects that are going forward. We've modified our contracts with the people we sell power to so that they can bring those projects online, then not have to come back to us and modify the contracts and go down to the RCA. So when and if they get those projects online, they'll just be able to go right in service, and we won't have that tariff problem with that. We're also supporting the Rail Belt Unified Power Provider, which we think is a necessary vehicle to be able to make that migration away from fossil fuels. Most of these things, require everybody working together to achieve that. They tend to be a little bit more expensive than conventional. And we've said it before, we don't think we can afford our future. We can't create an affordable future on our own. We need to work with everybody else. We're just hoping the problem's not bigger than all of us working together with the state.
Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Could you remind me again what, when you flip it from 9010 to 1090, where the other 90 is going to come from? You got 10% hydro now. Is it, what's your Ouija board telling you where you're going to generate this from?
Through the chair, and that is directly to this point here on the Unified Power Provider. We have several potential projects that are out on the board that we think are worth pursuing. I can't tell you that I have a shovel-ready project to go. We've been engaged in the Fire Island Wind project, which would be one. There's another one up that's outside of Healy, and there's yet again another one on Kenai. We think that would be good for a wind portfolio. It would give you geographical diversity so that the wind's blowing somewhere. If you have it all in one location and the wind stops, you've got to back that up. The obvious hydro project that we think is worth pursuing, and we were down here last year in support of that, was Susitna. We think that I know that the agency that's been charged with dusting off that study and finding out if they can right-size that project, where we came in and said, you know, originally that failed for various reasons, but one of the reasons it failed was that the project was too large, 1,500 megawatts, and we said there should be a way to scale that project to meet our needs today, and then reserve the ability to add on to it later if you have load growth. One example is you could civilly build the project to its ultimate construction, but only install the transmission in the powerhouse for the load you need today, and that's an expensive part of that. There's other proposals that it be built in stages as far as dam height and things like that. So we said right-sizing that might be the right approach to Susitna. We're looking at, there's been an interest in Chacachama that's outside Beluga. There's geothermal. There's several projects that are out there being evaluated right now. I can't tell you that there's a lead on any one of these. Tends to become, is it doable? Can we afford it? How much help do we need to get it done? But we think that you absolutely need the unification of the rail belt utilities to do this. It's not something that one utility can take on by themselves. We absolutely need to work together on this.
Just a quick follow-up.
Sure. Senator Stedman.
Can you get there without Susitna and Chimichanga? Can you get to your 90% target with other sources, wind and geothermal?
Through the chair, obviously Susitna would be a silver bullet on that, but I think it would take more time, and that I don't have a good answer for that. I just don't. It's a challenge to follow your vision and get there, but I don't know how quickly we could get there if we didn't do something on a large-scale hydro approach.
I want to note Senator Stevens joined us some time ago, right after the outset, and Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. My recollection of Susitna Hydro last year, just in some short hearings that we had, was that the full build-out would cost about $18 billion. And I'm wondering if you have, how far down the path you've gone, and at what point do you say, well, for $18 billion, maybe we do a bolt line or a gas line spur off a main line? I mean, do you have a take on that?
Well, through the chair, I think that's a high number for the ultimate build-out, although when you say that at 1,500 megawatts, if we were to build something on a 400-megawatt scale, if we scale that back, and that might approach an area where it's more doable. I until we get the numbers back from them, until we run it through an integrated resource plan model, I can't give you the precise answer that you're looking for. We need the numbers, preliminary engineering numbers, to know that.
And Madam Chair, I guess kind of the urgency for us is we're being pulled in a lot of directions this session to make investments or make law changes to incentivize the bolt line. And I guess it's an important factor, at least for me, to know where do we best allocate our resources and our efforts. So I just as the process moves along, I'd be interested in continuing to have your input on this issue. Well, as the main provider of electricity in our region.
Through the chair, that we're just about ready to issue the contract for the integrated resource plan for the electric utilities in the rail belt, and those numbers would be run through there, and there would be a preferred path to follow out of that, at least on an economic basis. There's other drivers in there, like you know, you might have mandates on renewables and emissions and environmental concerns and things like that that might make you pay a little bit more for one option versus the other, but on large scale we should be able to have a preferred path. And that should be done this year.
Just one last follow-up, Madam Chair. And you mentioned about getting all the utilities together, and I think it's a great idea. We talked about it a little bit in my office before. Do you see the governor's proposal to create a joint utility cooperative or commission as that path to go forward to do what you're thinking of doing?
Through the chair, I think that's the answer. The governor, from the address that she gave, supports what we're trying to accomplish. I think it came out of the industry. I've made it my own personal mission to make this happen because I think it's the only way to go forward to solve this problem in the most efficient manner. I mean, I've said it before. We're faced with unprecedented pressure and problems in our industry. I mean, globally, energy is one of the biggest problems out there for everybody, and it's no different here. We're not going to get there if we allow everybody to work. You know, it's a herd of kittens. I mean, they're going to be all over the place. We have to go in the same direction to make this work. So to the extent that the administration is supporting what we think needs to be done, we think that's a good thing. Now, that doesn't mean we have a detailed plan on everything. It's just that this is a journey, and it's going to start with the first step, and we think that's a good first step.
What to that end, Brad, and you have talked about this in the future, something like this coming together. You talked about this long before it was a governor initiative. What are the timelines? When do you see that proposal coming forward, and what kind of conversations have you been a part of?
We meet weekly on this right now with the other CEOs, with the administration, AEA. The RCA is there. We're trying to get something to the legislative body that would be enabling legislation that would set this process in motion, and it will take the first year to develop a more detailed transition plan for everybody, because it's not that easy. It's like bringing different businesses together. You can't just snap your fingers and make that happen. There's existing assets. How do those existing assets, do they have to transfer? Do they stay there? What's the best way to bring unification about? We have a plan that we think would work, but there's other people, other stakeholders that have to weigh in on whether that will work for them or not. So I'm hopeful that we can get that in and out of the legislative body this year.
Okay.
And start that process and come back and report our progress the following legislative session.
So when you say that, you mean enabling legislation that would set up the structure for the sort of a, I guess you'd say, a task force,
it's more along the lines of a corporation that we could all be in and working together and take over the GNT effort.
Okay. And would members would they be incentivized to come in as members? I mean, the utilities, how do you get their membership?
Oh, you hit on a very that's a really good question. I can say that Chugach is already there. I can't speak for everybody else. And I guess the incentive would be obvious if you're working together to achieve a more affordable future. I would hope that the governing bodies would say that was a better way to go. Working individually is inherently more risky in this environment.
Okay, last question. But so if you set up a co-op, corporation, whatever method you use to set up a structure, and you have individuals who agree to be members, then okay. But what if you have individual utilities that are part of this consideration that don't want to be members? what do you do there?
I think that's a problem. Obviously, it's a problem. But I think there's if somebody wants to be an outlier, there's potential to have services go back and forth. You know, they may contract services in, or they may buy power from the regional Rail Belt Energy Corporation. and they may continue to be outliers out there. But I think the incentive, if you look at the structural problems in the industry right now, there's a lot of incentive to work together, just built into the system because it's so problematic out there. You have
liquidity. How close are you? A couple weeks?
We're hopeful that we can get something to the administration here in a couple weeks, but you have a lot of divergent interest out there. I mean, I'm working on it as hard as I can.
Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Brad. And I think we're all behind you on this, but for just simplicity's sake, most things are easier broken down in phases. So if you had four or less phases, would you describe those to us to get to your last bullet, rail belt unification?
On unification, through the chair, on unification?
Unification.
Enabling legislation that would establish sort of a light framework around developing this. The first year would be spent studying an integrated resource plan to come up with an affordable future for everybody. That would be sort of two phases.
One year?
First year would be that, but that's kind of two phases. One looks at the infrastructure, one looks at the governance and the finance and all of that. So you've got two going at the same time. I think then you're going to have to look at financing matters to go and pursue that future, working together, and long term would be the vision of, you know, if you want to go renewables, if that's the direction we're headed and that we support that, then that would be your last phase. And I'm not sure I broke that down perfectly into four, but and I think in terms of the transition between the first year and the next few years, you're going to look at, when I say financing, you're going to look at the assets that are in play right now. We think it would be a very good thing to unify the transmission. Look at it as a highway system. Right now, if you're an IPP or you're a renewables developer and you have a project and you want to sell it to everybody, you have to go across a highway system that has various owners to get that, deliver that service to them and that energy to them. So you have to have different contracts for everybody. If you unified that highway system and you had one central place that you could go to shop your project, then when you got plugged into the grid, whether you were an IPP, renewable, or utility effort or state effort, you only have to deal with one person to make that happen. So we think that would be an important step in going down that direction. And then the next phase would be bleeding out the existing assets and replacing them with new assets.
Right. And Madam Chair, one final follow-up. Is there a prototypical model that you're mirroring someplace, somewhere, somehow?
Through the chair, I can't say, you know, Alaska's really unique in a lot of different ways. And sometimes it's just inappropriate to take large-scale systems and say, well, geez, it works for them and they have 10 million customers. Why doesn't it work for you and you've got a couple hundred thousand? I can say we're taking bits and pieces, but I can't say that there's a similarly situated area in the globe that's out there. You typically have to look at islanded systems and the struggles that they have. A lot of them aren't as large as Alaska, which has its own problems because we had local centers that grew up and then interconnected. If you look at Ireland or if you look at Hawaii or if you look at Puerto Rico or places like that, they've got unique islanded problems that are like ours, but and the governance thing and all the mix of all this, that's pretty unique to us. So I think you could look at, we're trying to create like a power authority type thing to do that, type entity. So we're trying to take the best of all the knowledge that everybody has out there to put something together that would work for Alaska, because we are pretty unique.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate being in the loop. Thanks for communicating with us.
Going back, and maybe this answers some more of the questions that were raised here, as we see where we are today, the activities that we have today on the left-hand side, kind of the mid-range activities in the middle, and then the vision of 2020 and beyond. And those are the activities we got. And in the middle, we came down and said, you know, we really do need to look at a bullet line, and I know that got mixed up with the spur line, and we're not here to pick a horse in that. We're here to say that those are potential solutions to the Cook Inlet gas problem. We have exploration that we think we need to look at a little bit more. We have LNG imports that are possibilities, and we have storage that I think all of the consumers can agree that we need here today. However, how much and exactly when That we need a little bit of work on, and we're going to get to that later. On the electric side, we're looking at reducing our load through more efficient generation, unifying the transmission to allow economic renewables to come in, and we're also looking at some dual fuel situations there as well. I think everyone knows natural gas is important to our regional economy. The problem that we're all facing right now is that, and I don't think anybody's like created this problem, it's just this is the way it happened. We're moving from an era of abundance to limited supply, and it raises issues. And there are issues that you didn't have to deal with before. And so, no, you can't say, well, this guy should have done this and this guy should have done that. That's not the way it is. I mean, right now we're in a transition, and security of supply is an issue and affordability is an issue, and those things collide with each other. Many organizations are involved. Chugach, NSTAR, the producers, DNR, DOR. I it's fair to say that everybody on that board has a different lens that they look through when they look at this issue, and they have different priorities. And a lot of the information and everything out there is resides in these organizations. We don't think that all of you've studied the Cook Inlet a lot. There's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of studies. We're not here to propose a study, but we can say that all of those efforts haven't produced a comprehensive plan for the resource management in the Cook Inlet, and that we think is lacking. Today, you know, you're in the midst of reservoir harvesting, limited exploration. On the supply management side, basically we rely on LNG interruptions when we have demand that outstrips deliverability or is stressing deliverability. On the demand side, we have LNG exports, gas utilities, electric utilities, military bases, and some of the management demand management stuff we're trying to do to reduce it is load interruptions and conservation. We don't want to do load interruptions, but we have some that we can do, like economy energy sales, or wherever somebody can go on to a different fuel to manage this problem. But we think we can do a lot better at that. That's kind of a snapshot for today. Driving that, I think everybody's seen this picture. You're falling off a cliff. We'll move on from there. But I think there's a couple different, if we look at this demand profile here and the resource profile, I think the black line represents the cliff that was on the prior one. And I think ANGDA did a lot of really good work looking at, you know, what could be done out in the Cook Inlet. I think you've had the Department of Natural Resources and I think you had the geological and geophysical surveys out there. There's a lot more potential out there that's not in production today. That's the blue line. We think we need to marry all of this up, because that looks like to us is something that we should strongly evaluate as a next step, is looking at bringing those things online. We know that there's at least one producer out there right now that's got a well that's producing, but he doesn't have a pipeline to get it into the system. So there is gas out there. If there is gas out there, it seems to me we should go after that and try to get it in the system before we run off and do a lot of other things. Now, that doesn't mean that says that you don't do an in-state bullet line. It just means that let's look at all of this thing to see how it all fits together. And so what we're suggesting here is a comprehensive Cook Inlet resource management plan. I know that's a lot to say. And we'd like it to meet and protect consumer needs, address security issues. We would really like it to increase transparency and information sharing amongst the consumers, to the extent possible to producers, and even within the state administration. We think there needs to be a lot of sunlight on this process. It's necessary to provide input to the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, which we're starting on here just shortly. It should provide guidance for investment decisions. We went down a long list of things that you could potentially do. We have to do storage, when and how much. LNG imports, if there's a gap, when and how much. Further exploration, when and how much. You've got all these when and how much things that you can do out there. You've done all the studies for it, but nobody's knit it together to make it work, and we think we need to do that. Optimizing the resource management would be important, and it would provide information for rational policy decisions around this, whether or not you're going to make a big investment in some other infrastructure mm-hmm. development, or whether there's still something left to be harvested here. And we think that we've studied this enough. We need some adult supervision to come in here and say, this is how we're going to manage this resource, and line everybody up and say, you know, we know our demand really well. We know some things that we're working on to try to reduce demand and things like that. But we could really use somebody to step in here, because as a consumer, and I'm here representing consumers, I don't have a stick for this. I can't whop somebody on the head and say, you know, you're going to drill here tomorrow, or you're going to drill there next year, or you're going to build storage, or you're going to allow these people to use your export facility for an I don't have that stick.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is to you is, who are you, to whom are you assigning this task? Because it's a great idea. I think it's a great, you know, a fantastic proposal. But I just want to make sure that we don't leave the room with someone thinking, well,
who has
the
stick?
Yeah, who's going to do this? Who's the best person in position to do this?
Through the chair, I we've got some suggestions, and I just throw it out on the table. I don't like investing this thing in one agency or part of the administration or something like that, because I think it crosses a lot of boundaries of divergent interest. I think that you have room to maybe have two pieces of the state administration be in charge of this, like, for example, DNR and DOR. And maybe that there's an advisory steering committee that they report to, so that there's a little sunshine on this process. That advisory committee might be the stakeholders, the consumers, the RCA, the producers, the various utilities that represent consumers. And, you know, in the end, we want to optimize the resource development, minimize the cost of doing that, and provide an affordable, secure future. So I'm making that as a suggestion, but I'm sure there's a lot of people who would like to be in charge of something like that. So I don't.
Senator.
Maybe ANGDA has a role.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Brad, this is a good idea. I think this merits some further discussion. I think you described it when we talked before in my office. You have all these silos of information out there, and there's nothing keeping things together and putting all this information together, and you have the LNG people off doing their thing, and NSTAR off doing their thing, and potentially hydro, and it all comes back to what we're wrestling with is a plan, and we need to start planning for this, because we're literally at the edge of a cliff. So I appreciate you bringing this up. I think it's a good idea. I think it merits further discussion quickly.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Brad, you've Charlie Huggins from Wasilla. You've hit on a very important point that's just clear as daylight to most people, and I think we thank you for reminding us. What you're hitting on is something that we're headed in the wrong direction on, and that is bringing the players together, the stakeholders, all right, and to bring visionary, some state government people, but the visionaries of the state that understand the mechanics, that are, quote, large business kinds of people. They don't have to be oil industry people or gas people, but they're part of the play. But the one, the most important, and the chair hit on it earlier, is shine some bright light on it, daylight. Because just like you were mentioning before, you've been doing all these things, and we're going to get some legislation here in the next 2 weeks. That's a technique, but not necessarily a good one, because we start at ground zero when the information is being floated around. We need to sort of simultaneously mature the information so that we can hit the ground running and not just be caught in a sprint after everybody else got completed with a marathon. That's the first part. The second part, Don, I'm going to look back retrospectively and ask you a question. The previous administration had pursued a concept of the state facilitating bringing in one or more jackup rigs in Cook Inlet to facilitate exploration. Your thoughts on that, and do you know what happened to that initiative previously if you were involved with it?
Through the chair, I think that was a really important initiative. I can't really speak to whether it was – I don't fully understand. Again, there's maybe not enough transparency on that. I'm not really sure. Maybe that information's out there, and I'm just dense and don't keep up. But you're really hitting on part of the what needs to happen out here. If there's the ability to produce more in the Cook Inlet, we need to take a look at that as part of the answer. I can't speak to exactly where that process is at with the state. I read that they're having some difficulty with that, but I think if we're going to go in there and we're going to develop resources in the Cook Inlet, and we already know that region is scarce, and all the solutions to the problem are really expensive, maybe we need to take a different look at how we issue leases out there, and what we do when we issue a lease. maybe the sky's not the limit on something like that, and maybe we have to take a different look on how we partner with these people that come in and do these developments so that the expectations of the residents and the consumers are met at the same time that you don't disenfranchise a developer so much that they won't come in. I know that's a delicate balance, but I also know that in the entire world that not all the gas and oil out there is done according to our model. I mean, there's many different ways to get the job done out there, and I think for once maybe we need to take a look at how do we develop that resource in the best interest of the people who live here. And it's not always maximize revenue. It's not always maximize profits. I think we need to balance that.
Just throwing things over here.
Oh.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, what rights a private company has to maximize their profits and have development plans versus the consumers in our region and clearly a potential shortage. So, further discussion?
Just one final closing was just the last slide was a look at sort of how we envision the future a little bit here where we continue to do the harvesting that we're doing now. Expanded exploration. We need to take a serious look at a bullet line, spur line concept. You know, we would think that maybe there's a possibility to continue the exports, meet the demands of the utilities and users. More texture on the demand management, conservation, efficiency, renewables, and dual fuel, and supply management, and doing the storage, I think, is really pretty important. It's probably one of the most important next steps that we take. I just want to make sure that we rationalize that investment and we've done the right thing at the right time because we do have to answer to the people we serve.
Thank you very much. We
appreciate Minister, one,
it. Yes, sir.
Just one final question. It has to do with coal. Right? You didn't say coal. I said coal. My utility, MEA, got skewered because they were pursuing a course of action that potentially would have involved coal. About 2 o'clock this morning, I was watching the news, and we're talking about, in the state of Illinois, clean coal in the stimulus package, which is interesting, the governor's home state. So my question for you is that part of a scenario potentially for you in some phase of this?
Through the chair, Chugach actually spent quite a bit of effort, and I headed that up myself. We did work with the Tsuit'ina people and looking at a coal model out at Beluga. We really wanted to go down the coal gasification path if we were to choose coal versus conventional pulverized or fluidized bed. We think that out of the coal gasification, you actually get the byproduct of, you know, the CO2, which can be used in the oil and gas industry and enhance recovery out in the Cook Inlet, so you had a ready market to use that would facilitate enhanced recovery. It does come along with a lot of risk, which we thought by ourselves we couldn't take that on. Again, unification might open that back up. But coal comes along with a lot of other things. It's not very popular. There's a lot of risk in it in terms of cap and tax, trading systems, how much you're going to be taxed on that going forward. There was inherently a lot of risk in that. And it was expensive. We thought that the coal gasification technology itself was a little bit, it wasn't mature enough for us to take that risk here in Alaska, because when you have project failure, you don't have backup, you've got a bigger problem than you started out with, and that is you invest a lot of money, and you now what do? So we thought that maybe somewhere down the road, in the next decade or so, you could look at coal gasification if it could be done responsibly and environmentally safe. We thought the industry needed to mature a little bit for us. Otherwise, we were going to have to go down conventional, and conventional carries an awful lot of risk in it. So we look around us and we see we have a lot of other resources that could be developed, hydro, geothermal, wind. We think that it should be a balanced approach to everything. Have we shut the door on some sort of coal option? And the answer is no. Does it have its challenges? The answer is yes.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Okay, next we have Colleen Starring with NSTAR. We'll just take a brief at ease to allow her to set up. Thank you. And we have Colleen Starring with us. Welcome back to Senate Resources.
Thank you. Many of the slides that I'm going to go over today are a different format, but pretty much the same information that Chugach just delivered to you. And this is not the correct technology. Don't we love it? It appears what I have here is the presentation that we gave to the Senate Resources Committee 2 weeks ago.
Can you take a brief, Eddie?
I do.
Gracious Colleen Starring, who's going to go through the old-fashioned way of presenting her overview.
We're going to do this with paper in lieu of technology. The first graph that you're looking at is NSTAR's supply outlook as it looks today, 10 years out. The heavy blue line is our Beluga contract tied to oil. The red line is our Marathon contract, which is tied to oil. The small, the little bit of pink and yellow you see in there, those are the new contracts. Well, they're not new contracts. Those are deals that we have with both Conoco and Marathon, and they are selling us gas at the weighted average cost of the system. And that's what we cobbled together in order to get those volumes in and be able to serve our customers. As you look out further, our Beluga contract, which is green, goes away this year. And when you get into 11, we have as much as a 10 BCF shortfall, and that continues to grow. Unocal has the option to step down their contract by 3 BCF each year going out, and 2008 was the first year that they stepped down 3 BCF for 2013. The next slide is the in-state gas market as we see it today, and the entities that are receiving gas from Cook Inlet now are listed there in yellow. It's the electric companies, NSTAR. There's some LNG export. You could have a revamped Agrium. The light green is Fairbanks, the military bases, two of which are receiving gas from Cook Inlet, both Elmendorf and Fort Richardson. And then Fairbanks Natural Gas, who currently they liquefy a BCF of gas out in Port McKenzie and truck it north to the Fairbanks system.
Colleen, can I interrupt you briefly? The thumb drive is here. Would you like to put it in?
Certainly.
Okay. Brief Eddies. On the record, thank you, Shalon.
Yep. And I think we left with the light green circles and the darker green, I'll call them teal, are current or future markets that could be served if there were additional gas available through something like a bullet line. The next slide shows the current demand using our forecast out 10 years, what we think the demand could be in the interior and in South Central. NSTAR is projected to be about 42 BCF a year. Power generation, we were very conservative in that regard because, as Brad talked about, the renewables, and we don't know what effect that will be. There could be less of a demand. They're talking about new generation, which is more efficient. And so we projected the power load out equal. LNG, this is LNG as it was being exported when the plant was at full capacity. If the Agrium plant were to come back on, and then other Cook Inlet industrials, the BP to liquids plant and Tesoro, we're looking at 221 BCF of year or 606 of daily deliverability. This slide, it's an important piece of information and a critical piece to the story right now in regards to the deliverability in the Cook Inlet. If you go back to 1999, 10 years ago, we had a peak day on our system. It was negative 19 degrees, and NSTAR transported 272 million cubic feet and so on down till you get to the 763, which was the daily deliverability for that peak day. Now, at that point, you had the LNG plant at full capacity exporting, and you had the ammonia plant. Contrast that to 7 years later, we had a negative 10. We have the LNG plant at reduced capacity, The fertilizer plant, Agrium, is not using anything, and we only had deliverability in the inlet of 543 million cubic feet. So over that seven-year period, about a 30% per year decline in deliverability. And then where we were this year, we experienced a new peak day on the system on January 3rd. That was a holiday weekend. It was a Saturday. Businesses and schools, for the most part, were closed. It was only 11 degrees below zero. NSTAR transported 314 million cubic feet a day. The deliverability in the inlet was only 440 million cubic feet. What's interesting is the LNG plant, which diverts in those times of need, was down to 40 million cubic feet of reserve. That's what was left in the inlet. And NSTAR is concerned that as we look out and have a sustained cold period, that we are not going to be able to meet the demand. What have we done to address some of the issues we've faced in terms of deliverability? These are all various projects that have been completed in the last 2 years, and we spent $4.2 million in capital to address these system issues. About 5 to 6 years ago, we've seen the gas supply that used to come from the west side. Most of the supply now is on the east side, and we've had to reconfigure the system and increase pressures and add compression to be able to get the gas where we need it at the certain times we need it. What are we looking at future that could be done to help the situation we have in the inlet right now in the next few years? The Cook Inlet gathering system could be a bidirectional line. NSTAR is looking at increasing compression on our 12 and 16 inch twin lines down on the east side of the inlet. We could look at some kind of a subsidization of the tariffs. And then there's LNG regasification, which we are exploring, and other storage.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
I'm just a little curious about that first bullet point. I don't quite understand what you mean by incentives to deliver gas on the west side.
There are tariffs associated with each of the pipelines, and most of the gas now comes from the east side, and so there are tariffs involved when you ship back to the west, and there could be some kind of a reduction in the tariff on that line, on that Beluga line, or some kind of a reimbursable tariff, and those are RCA-approved ideas.
I guess I have a simpler question. Maybe you can just tell the public why, since everybody sort of lives on the east side, we want to ship gas to the west side.
What we've done is it's where the gas fields are and where we have to get it at that exact time. I think I've actually said it wrong. It's everybody's on the east side, and the deliverability has shifted from the west to the east. So through the chair, thank you, Senator French.
So if that's at east side, we'd all be okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Right.
Well, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Madam Chairman. Some of us live on the west side.
Who?
Who are those people?
These are the ideas that we're exploring in terms of storage. We have a requirement to develop storage, and what we're looking at now is the existing LNG facility. Is it possible that that's available for use for regas? Do we build a new LNG facility or new storage facility? We've looked at infield storage, and we haven't been able to find a reservoir that is suitable to what we need. We're in discussions with a few parties, and as we look out, we think that probably infield storage is something that would be a good partnership for all of the utilities, Chugach, MLMP, to develop something together.
Question.
Yes, Senator French.
Regarding the LNG facility, someone recently grabbed me and told me that the answer to all our problems, or at least one important component of getting between now and first gas through either a bullet line or a big line or any whatever it is that brings it into the south central region, is an LNG import facility. The ability to bring a ship from overseas or wherever it comes from and plug it into the system and have the ability during cold winter months to fill the potential gap you pointed to in an earlier slide. Have you had discussions or looked into how much that would cost, or whether even the plant that's on the peninsula could simply, you know, turn the valves around and bring LNG off a tanker onto the system?
Through the chair, yes, we have it on the next slide. I mean, we've looked at regasification equipment, which would address that need.
Thank you.
And it goes to what are some of the things that we don't know. What we do know is we believe that LNG facility is critical to South Central, both for our short-term and mid-term and long-term needs. But it has many issues around it. There's FERC issues. We could use it as a peak shaving facility, installing regas equipment at the plant, and then being able to regas as we need it and take seasonal gas off of it. It could be used with the regas equipment as an import facility. We could look at bringing a ship in to supply our peak needs as early as 2011. Yeah. And I, you know, right now I don't know what the cost of that LNG would be, so it's hard to determine if that's the best choice. But that regasification equipment would allow that to happen. And I
have a question. I understand three of those four subpoints, and the one I don't get is a peak shaving facility operation. What is that?
Through the chair. Peak shaving is we buy our gas, or we look at our gas supply in terms of you have base gas, which is the same amount of gas that you flow all year long. And then you have seasonal gas, which is in the shoulder months, the colder months. And then you have peak needs. And that's why NSTAR's load is so hard to serve. I mean, we can have an 8-to-1 swing. There may be 11 days a year where we need that peak amount of gas for that coldest time of year. It's very difficult to supply, and you could have gas regas at the LNG facility and pull it quickly out of that facility to suit our needs in those cold periods.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Madam Chairman, I'd just like to reemphasize what Colleen said, because I think she put it as succinctly as I've heard, that when you look at the LNG facility, the dynamics, the diversity, and the keys it holds to lots of scenarios, we can't turn our back on. And it didn't mean you have to like LNG. The capability flowing both ways, emergencies, expansion. So it's one of those things, and I just thank you for pointing that out, because it is. It's hugely important mm-hmm. to our neighborhood in the near term anyway.
Absolutely. Unknown sources, new supply. There is some activity going on. There is a producer in the inlet that has proved up 8 BCF of gas. We've had some discussions with them. And as Brad mentioned, there's the little issue of there's no pipeline there yet. And it's about a $20 million expenditure, as near as we can tell. And we're looking at the ability to do that. That could help in the short term. And it would allow them to do additional exploration, monetize their gas at this point in time. Is it the answer? Is it enough to say, okay, we're taken care of for the long term? We don't think so. World energy prices are an unknown. I mean, the idea of importing LNG into Alaska, it seems foreign to me, but, we'll have to review it at the time, and it may be an option for us. It might be the only option for us. The regulatory environment, it's not a news story that we've been negotiating contracts for the last 4 years. We bought four contracts in front of the RCA. We have not been successful with gaining approval of those contracts. And we currently, a week ago, we sent out an RFP to seven producers. We asked for strict compliance with the RCA's order number 8. And we're hopeful that we'll get a response on that RFP to be able to purchase gas that we need in 2011.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Colleen, when you go through the RFP process and you complete with the RCA, what's the price tag that ends up that you end up paying when it's all said and done for that process?
Individual year, right now we have, for the last 2 years, we've incurred $2.3 million in legal fees and other costs associated with the negotiation and the approval process of contracts.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think one of the, those of us sitting up here are the ones who hear the complaints from constituents when the prices go up. And I think one of the biggest problems I see it is, The prices, there are huge spikes, and there are a lot of people on fixed incomes. Is it possible now with gas at $4.80 trading Henry Hub, is it possible to lock in long term so that people will know and be able to plan for their energy bills? I mean, it's a huge problem all throughout South Central, all throughout Alaska, but is it possible to lock in low rates now for the next 20 years? And maybe the rates dip a little bit, but they're probably going to increase, and at least we have some certainty for Alaskan consumers.
Through the chair, is it possible, you know, as we don't own the resource, so as we negotiate with the producers, it's a price negotiation. Henry Hub is at a record low, and we most likely will have a good story to tell when we announce the cost of gas for 2010, because one of our contracts, a significant portion of our contract, is tied to a Henry Hub contract, and they've been at the $4 and $5 range. We've still got two legacy contracts tied to oil. I've been involved in a company where we did have we called it a frozen program, where we were able to negotiate a supply, and this is several years ago, and at that time it was $5, and it was a long, difficult process to get it approved, but over the life of that five-year contract, consumers in a small community saved over $60 million. So there are programs out there available like that.
And I guess just I'd like to see efforts to try to do that, because we know that the Japanese were paying very low rates, in fact, half what Cook Inlet consumers were in at one point for quite a period of time. And part of the reason we were told was because they negotiated long-term contracts. And I'd love, and I think all of our constituents would love to see mm-hmm. us really take advantage of the low rates right now and try to lock in something for long term.
Absolutely. Through the chair, I understand that.
Yep.
So, I mean, in conclusion, we've seen the inlet deliverability continue to decline. I think you've heard from DNR and others. That, you know, mostly there is gas available in the Cook Inlet. What's the cost to explore, and what's the likelihood that we're going to prove up the reserves that we need in the time we need it? We have to continue to make infrastructure investments to just be able to ensure the energy security of our residential, commercial, and industrial mm-hmm. current customers. And we're a public utility. We have a duty to serve. We not only have to take care of our current customers, but their future customers' needs. Yep. And utilities, producers, regulators, policymakers, and our customers are going to have to work together on the right solution. And NSTAR believes that a bullet line is the right solution, that the time is now to move forward with that. And that's what, at this point, we intend to do.
Excellent. Senator Willikowski.
Just real quick, and not to get into a huge discussion on this because we've got other presenters, but we just heard from Anadarko last week, who said that the absolute earliest they could get gas was 2016. Yeah. And we've heard you, NSTAR, testify that you needed gas by 2015. How do we... and of course, the further we push it down, you know, if it's 2016, then it's really probably 2017 or 2018. And of course, the big line is supposed to be online around 2018. So,
through the chair, I got a lot of phone calls on that comment.
Yes, I bet you did.
And what I've said is, you know, is there a disconnect? There's not a disconnect in terms of, are we communicating with Anadarko on a regular basis? And they've said, this is their timeline and their earliest date, and it was 2016 or 17. And NSTAR's need, based on our supply portfolio, is 2015. We've got to have gas then. Are there ways to bridge that gap, that year gap? There are, we believe. I mean, we could do something with storage. There could be additional resources found. Doyon's delivering or drilling in Nanana Canyon. That may be an option. And frankly, if we get to the point a year from now that we've got to move forward, we've engineered a line. I think everybody's seen on our maps there's a dotted line to the North Slope, and we would start those discussions.
And so we heard from Chugach and this idea of having a comprehensive plan for Cook Inlet. Is that something that NSTAR supports?
Actually, Brad and I have talked about it briefly, and the concept. I would say certainly we would support that.
And what about the idea of an integrated co-op? Have you been part of the discussions that that Brad had discussed, the weekly meetings?
We haven't. As the natural gas utility, and we deliver the molecules. They use the molecules to generate. So fundamentally, the business is a little different. We did have a meeting right before the holidays with Steve Haggison and Jim Strandberg, where they talked about this co-op idea and asked if we'd be interested. And I said, you know, I'd have to see what the plan is and what it looked like before I could say, yes, we support it. But we are open to listening to any of the ideas.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Colleen, storage. What could you give us a quick view from your perspective, NSTAR, of what dynamic that creates for you and what capabilities it creates for you? And the administration is talking about they're trying to expand the storage capacity.
Through the chair, storage in the short term, we've got to develop it to meet our seasonal or our peaking needs. Long term, if there's a big line, the optimum way to flow that line is the same amount every day, and it's not going to want to ramp up and ramp down. So storage is a critical piece of the infrastructure that needs to be developed. The producers have some storage. It's limited. And NSTAR feels that it's time for the utilities to step up and take care of our own needs going forward. Storage would smooth out the costs for our customers because we would have the ability to buy the gas, you know, in non-peak times when prices were lower and store it for use in the peak times.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Colleen. We appreciate it.
I apologize again for the technology glitch.
No apologies needed. Okay, next we have Jim Posey, who's off net from MLNP. Jim, are you there?
Jim is not here at the Anchorage LIL. He had to leave.
Okay, so next we've got Bob Pickett, the chairman of the RCA. Are you there, Bob?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Good afternoon. Thank you for your patience. And if you'd go ahead and offer your testimony.
Very good. Co-chairs McGuire and Willikowski, members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Bob Pickett. I'm chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to participate in this hearing and offer our perspective on this very important matter. With me at the Anchorage LIO are Stuart Gehring. He's an assistant attorney general assigned to the RCA. He is sitting next to me to make sure that I do not veer into any matters of prohibited ex parte communication. In the audience, Commissioner Tony Price of the RCA and Administrative Law Judge J.B. Wood. Natural gas is critically important to the residents and businesses in the Cook Inlet region. As you're aware, the RCA is the state agency that you've empowered to protect Alaska's ratepayers from unfair and unreasonable, unjust rates for public utility service. And a very important component of the rate for a public utility service is the price of gas in South Central Alaska. These prices are passed through to the consumers directly, so any increase or decrease in the price of natural gas has an immediate effect on business owners or families' economic well-being. As mentioned by several of the earlier presenters, we are going from an era of relative abundance and very inexpensive natural gas into which the constraints on the supply and deliverability are much more apparent. Over the last 5 years in Cook Inlet, ratepayers have seen an unprecedented increase in the price of natural gas. A typical large commercial user in 2003 paid $17,000 for natural gas supplies. While using that same amount of natural gas in 2009, a large commercial user would pay $44,000. In 2003, the price per MCF for NSTAR was roughly $2.55. This year, 2009, we're looking at $8.75, which is nearly double the Henry Hub pricing index at this point. what is the RCA role when it comes to natural gas and Cook Inlet? You know, as you're aware, the RCA does regulate utilities under Alaska Statute 4205 and natural gas pipelines under 4206 for in-state service. We are involved in the natural gas arena in a couple of ways. We do not directly regulate the producers of natural gas in Cook Inlet. But the RCA does evaluate gas sale agreements between utilities and the producers. The RCA standard of review considers whether the utility acted in a prudent manner, whether the terms of the gas sale agreement are reasonable, and whether the gas sale agreement ensures reliable and reasonably priced utility service. In this responsibility, the RCA is guided by Alaska Statute 4205-431A. Under the subsection, the RCA is required to determine whether a gas sale agreement or particular terms within such an agreement are unjust, unreasonable, unduly discriminatory, or preferential. When making this determination, the utility filing a gas sale agreement with the RCA has the burden of proof. And the RCA does base its decision on the record developed in the proceeding. Now, this determination must be viewed in the context of Cook Inlet, which is unique among natural gas markets in the United States. The reserves production ratio for Cook Inlet for approximately 10 to 1. And this is in the same range as typical for lower 48 production areas. Cook Inlet's unique is the home of the only plant in the United States that liquefies natural gas and ships it out of the immediate area as LNG, and has been doing so for 40 years. The RCA has determined that Cook Inlet is a natural gas production basin.
Madam Chair, if I could ask...
Senator French.
Thank you. Why is that last finding significant? That seems like something that most people would sort of naturally assume is true. What difference does that finding make in anyone's lives?
In terms of the finding that Cook Inlet is the home of the only LNG plant?
No, the one after that, the RCA has found that Cook Inlet is a natural gas production basin.
Yes, Senator French, here's the significance of that. In looking at the Cook Inlet Basin, two of the 100 largest fields in the United States, the Beluga River Field and the North Cook Inlet Field, are present. So, you know, we're not a consumption basin. When you look at pricing mechanisms that exist, a pricing point at a city gate area or a consumption basin will be significantly higher than those found in production basins. And the difference between the two is the cost of gas. Generally, a consumption basin is far from the source and incurs additional transportation rates to ship the gas in the lower 48, many times thousands of miles. Does that address your question, Senator French?
It sounds like the upshot to a consumer is that in a production basin, you would normally find prices lower than in a consumption basin.
That is normally the case, yes.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Okay. The commission has also found that the Cook Inlet market is unique in terms of the presence of market power. ConocoPhillips, Marathon, and Union Oil of California, which is a division of Chevron Union, control the vast majority of natural gas that is supplied in Cook Inlet. Of these three, ConocoPhillips and Marathon are the two largest. ConocoPhillips and Marathon also own the Kenai LNG export facility. The Cook Inlet market's vertically integrated, with the two largest producers being their own best customers through the medium sales to the LNG export facility, which leads to the issue of pricing Cook Inlet gas. Cook Inlet is not an open and transparent natural gas market. No commonly accepted natural gas pricing mechanism exists in Cook Inlet. And since the what is commonly called the Henry Hub order, the 2001 RCA Henry Hub order, a variety of pricing proxies have been considered by utilities, producers, the Attorney General, and the RCA. To date, none of these pricing proxies has resulted in an RCA-approved gas sale agreement that currently delivers gas to utility customers. I would like to offer a couple of other comments specifically related to the LNG plant and the findings of the commission. We did find on our review of our latest record, which resulted from nearly 3.5 weeks of hearings and probably an approximate 10,000 pages of record, that the Department of Energy's decision to extend the producer's export authority negatively impacted NSTAR's negotiating position with resulting terms of the contracts brought forth to the commission. We do recognize, and I want to stress this very strongly, and it would echo some comments made by Mr. Evans of ChewGas, that I think it's important that we look at Cook Inlet as an overall system, incorporating both the regulated utilities, unregulated producers, and just the impact it has on residences, businesses, and the whole inlet. And the idea of a comprehensive resource management plan, I do think, is a sound one that should be pursued. But we clearly do recognize the importance of the LNG export facility, and it's a great benefit to the state of Alaska as a whole, and that the export of LNG does, in fact, stimulate exploration and the development of new reserves. Having said that, we also believe that it's in the interest of the local utility ratepayers to require that the producers finalize the contracts with the local utilities before receiving authorization to export natural gas. At this point, I will open it up to any questions from the committee.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator French.
Just one, and that's relating to the first bullet point on the last slide that we have, which is pricing Cook Inlet gas. What specific steps could we take to make Cook Inlet an open and transparent natural gas market?
That's an extremely difficult question to answer. The RCA does not have the ability to compel non-regulated producers to do anything. And that's the simple fact of the matter. I do think it is in the interest of all of the parties, utilities, the producers, the RCA, to realize that we're at what I would consider to be a somewhat of a tipping point for the inlet. And to continue the commercial and industrial side and meet the needs of the consumers, I think it's very important that some reasonable proxy be developed or accepted or mechanism, and I do think that our order EO858-8 is a good starting point.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pickett, I just want to commend you and the RCA. I know you're under tremendous pressure, and you get hit from a lot of different sides, and I appreciated your decision and trying to protect the consumers of Alaska and keep gas prices at a reasonable rate. And to that end, I wanted to ask you, where are we? You issued an order effectively denying the requested rate increases for future years and saying that they should be capped at other production basins throughout the country, particularly in Texas, Oklahoma, and Alberta. What's the status of that, of the litigation and the rate increase at this point?
The extent we are not involved in any litigation resulting from UO858 at this time. As Ms. Starring testified, NSTAR is using the WACOG, weighted average cost of gas, in Cook Inlet, which is allowed under their existing tariff and has been in place since 1981.
And that's, if I could, Madam Chair, effectively allowed them to, instead of charging their requested 22% to charge, I think, a 21.9% rate?
No, I don't know the exact differences, but that sounds approximately correct. The bottom line is, in 2009, they are entitled to collect roughly $8.75 for MCF.
And have the contracts been renegotiated to the satisfaction of the RCA for outlying future years?
It is my understanding that NSTAR has executed the two contracts for a two-year period. And as Ms. Starring said, they have an RFP on the streets currently to look to the outlying years.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much to you and all the other commissioners for your hard work and service. Okay, finally, we have Daniel Patrick O'Tierney. Are you there?
I am here, Madam Chairman. Can you hear me?
We can, and we apologize for the lateness of the hour. Perhaps you could give a thumbnail sketch of your perspective. It's almost 5 now, and then we could have you back later.
That must mean in 60 seconds or less.
Maybe 5 minutes.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I didn't necessarily prepare, an hour soliloquy for you, but I have a lot of observations about all of what's been presented thus far, and maybe I'll just, in terms of keeping it short for you as you close your hearing, the last question asked, what is the status as we speak today? The last question asked of Chairman Pickett, and the status is that from the perspective of the Attorney General and his role as the public advocate is that the Commission has articulated a standard, which is the end result of the docket U0858 that Chairman Pickett referenced, as prompted by Senator Wilkowski's question, a standard which essentially adopts a price proxy index that consists of a number of production basin price points in sort of a market basket that's averaged, and that mechanism is meant to serve as a cap on pricing in the Cook Inlet. Given that it is a very imperfect market, and therefore a price proxy index is necessary in the first instance, and that's what the Commission in its, after a good deal of deliberation, a lot of hard work, and a lot of think power came up with. I have to confess that it is very consistent, or considerably consistent with the advocacy of the Attorney General in this case and in prior cases, that advocacy being that a market basket approach to a price proxy index is probably the best free market or substitute for a free market driven price, since it isn't an imperfect marketplace in the Cook Inlet. So we endorse that decision and we applaud that decision. The question now is what the producers and NSTAR will be able to do with it. That's where we are. Meanwhile, Chugach, as you know, is in the midst of ongoing negotiations to attempt to negotiate its own supply contract going forward. With that recent Commission decision, I think is the last stake in the sand. That's 120 seconds or less.
Yeah,
Madam Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Artini, I appreciate your advocacy on behalf of the consumers of Alaska, South Central in particular, and I guess what's the hammer that is available to the people of Alaska so that we can enforce the action of the RCA? Have you contemplated intervening in that Ninth Circuit case to say, you know what, we're not going to allow you to ship our gas overseas if you're not going to sell us our gas at what our commission has deemed to be a reasonable price? Have you contemplated that?
You raised the current Ninth Circuit appeal of the DOE decision instigated by Chugach Electric, and I guess I can say two things. One is, it's not clear to me that the Attorney General, in his capacity as the public advocate under existing statute, is actually empowered to unilaterally take that action in a Ninth Circuit context. But the second point that I can make is that the state, Cross State, has intervened in that proceeding and is a party to it as we speak. I think that's a that's the second point that I can make, but I can't speak further to it because I'm not a part of the state's effort in that forum. My section, the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section, is not prosecuting that that case as a, for the state as a party.
So, Madam, just quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Is there a contingency plan to I guess require that we have adherence to the RCA order so that we can start getting low-cost gas for Alaskans?
I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski, could you just repeat
yeah.
that?
Yeah, do you have any suggestions or what is the state's plan to try to have enforcement of the RCA order or try to get low-cost gas to Alaskans?
Well, from our perspective, the RCA order stands relative to DACA UOA 58, I believe is what you're referencing, and it can only be applied when there's a contract in hand to apply it to. So first there has to be a contract on the table between a Cook Inlet producer supplier and a supply recipient. That could be Chugach in the next instance, or I suppose it's possible it could be NSTAR in the next or second instance. Once those are presented for commission review, there'll be an opportunity for the Attorney General as the public advocate to participate and or the state in its capacity as the cross state if one of the other state agencies sees fit. That's not a decision I would make, by the way.
Thank you.
Has there been any, you may or may not know this, it's a little bit more DNR's purview, but any discussion of changing the way leases are offered, the terms and the conditions in Cook Inlet? Moving forward?
That's not a question that I'm really in a position to answer. But what I can offer is that, in fact, there were representatives from DNR this very morning who were making a presentation before the RCA at one of its scheduled public meetings, and they actually did speak to some of their current thinking about leaseholds as it relates to storage and other things. I can't recall anything further than that. It's probably not appropriate for me to even if I could recall, to carry on about it. But that presentation did occur today. You might seek out further information from those parties.
I will. Thank you very much. Okay, anything further? Okay, with that, we're adjourned.